were one of the outcomes of what is often now called the conflict of the orders, the Latin word ordo meaning, among other things, social rank, which, according to Roman writers, dominated domestic politics in those crucial couple of hundred years after the end of the monarchy. This was the struggle by the plebeian citizens for full political rights and for parity with the elite patrician citizens, who were generally loath to give up their hereditary monopoly of power. In Rome, it was seen ever after as a heroic vindication of the political liberty of the ordinary citizen, and it has left its mark on the politics and political vocabulary of the modern world too. The word plebeian remains an especially loaded term in our class conflicts. Even in 2012, the allegation that a British Conservative politician had insulted a policeman by calling him a pleb, short for plebeian, led to his resignation from the government. As the story of this conflict unfolds, it was only a few years after the Republic had been established at the beginning of the 5th century BCE that the plebeians began objecting to their exclusion from power and their exploitation by the patricians. Why fight in Rome's wars, they repeatedly asked, when all the profit of their service lined patrician pockets? How could they count themselves full citizens when they were subject to random and arbitrary punishment, even enslavement if they fell into debt? What right had the patricians to keep the plebeians as an underclass? Or, as Livy scripted the ironic words of one plebeian reformer in terms uncannily reminiscent of 20th century opposition to apartheid, "Why don't you pass a law to stop a plebeian from living next door to a patrician, or walking down the same street, or going to the same party, or standing side by side in the same forum?" In 494 BCE, plagued by problems of debt, the plebeians staged the first of several mass walkouts from the city, a combination of a mutiny and a strike to try to force reform on the patricians. It worked, for it launched a long series of concessions which gradually eroded all the significant differences between patricians and plebeians, and effectively rewrote the political power structure of the city. 200 years later, there was little to patrician privilege beyond the right to hold a few ancient priesthoods and to wear a particular form of fancy footwear. The first reform in 494 BCE was the appointment of official representatives, known as tribunes of the people, tribuni plebis, to defend the interests of the plebeians. Then a special assembly was established for plebeians only. This was organised like the centuriate assembly on a system of block voting, but the technical details were crucially different. It was not based on a hierarchy of wealth. Instead, the voting groups were defined geographically with voters enrolled in tribes, tribus, or regional subdivisions of Roman territory, nothing to do with any ethnic grouping that the modern sense of tribe might imply. Finally, after one last walkout in a reform that Scipio Barbatus would have witnessed in 287 BCE, the decisions of this assembly were given the automatic binding force of law over all Roman citizens. A plebeian institution, in other words, was given the right to legislate over and on behalf of the state as a whole. Between 494 and 287 BCE, amid yet more stirring rhetoric, strikes and threats of violence, all major offices and priesthoods were step by step opened up to plebeians, and their second-class status was dismantled. One of the most famed plebeian victories came in 326 BCE, when the system of enslavement for debt was abolished, establishing the principle that the liberty of a Roman citizen was an inalienable right. An equally significant but more narrowly political milestone had been passed 40 years earlier, in 367 BCE. After decades of dogged refusal and claims by hardline patricians that it would be a crime against the gods to let a plebeian be consul, it was decided to open up one of the consulships to plebeians. From 342 BCE, it was agreed that both consuls could be plebeian if so elected. By far the most dramatic events in the conflicts surrounded the drafting of the 12 tables in the mid-5th century BCE. The clauses that are preserved may be brief, elusive, and even slightly dry, but as the Romans told the story, they were compiled in an atmosphere involving a tragic, highly coloured mixture of deception, allegations of tyranny, attempted rape, and murder. The story was that for several years the plebeians had demanded that the city's laws be made public and not be merely a secret resource for the patricians. And, as a concession, normal political offices were suspended in 451 BCE, and 10 men, decemviri, were appointed to collect, draft, and publish them. In the first year, the decemviri successfully completed 10 tables of laws, but the job was not finished. So, for the following year, another board was appointed, which proved to be of a very different and far more conservative character. This second board produced the remaining two tables, introducing a notorious clause banning marriage between patricians and plebeians. Although the initiative behind the drafting had originally been reformist, it turned into the most extreme attempt to keep the two groups utterly separate. The most inhuman law, Cicero called it, entirely against the spirit of Roman openness. There was worse to come. This second board of decemviri, the ten Tarquins, as they were sometimes known, started to ape the behaviour of tyrants, right down to sexual violence. In what was almost a replay of the rape of Lucretia, which had led to the foundation of the Republic, one of their number, the patrician, Appius Claudius, a great-great-grandfather of the road-builder, demanded sex with a young plebeian woman, the aptly named Virginia, unmarried but betrothed. Deception and corruption followed. Appius suborned one of his hangers-on to claim that she was his slave who had been stolen by her so-called father. The judge in the case was Appius himself, who, of course, found in his accomplice's favour, and strode through the forum to grab Virginia. In the argument that followed, her father, Lucius Virginius, picked up a knife from a nearby butcher's stall and stabbed his daughter to death. "I am making you free, my child, in the only way I can," he shouted. Virginia's story has always been even more unsettling than that of Lucretia. It not only combines domestic murder with the brutality of class conflict, but inevitably raises the question of the price to be paid for chastity. What kind of model of fatherhood is this? Who was most at fault? Did high principles need to come at such a terrible cost? But once more, attempted rape turned out to be a catalyst of political change. The display of Virginia's body and a passionate speech that Virginius gave to the army led to riots, mutiny, the abolition of the tyrannical board of decemviri, and, as Livy puts it, the recovery of liberty. Despite the taint of tyranny, the 12 tables remained. They were soon regarded as the honoured ancestor of Roman law, excluding the ban on intermarriage, which was quickly repealed. This story of the conflict of the orders adds up to one of the most radical and coherent manifestos of popular power and liberty to survive from the ancient world. Far more radical than anything to survive from classical democratic Athens, most of whose writers, when they had anything explicitly to say on the subject, were opposed to democracy and popular power. Taken together, the demands put into the mouths of the plebeians offered a systematic programme of political reform based on different aspects of the freedom of the citizen, from freedom to participate in the government of the state and freedom to share in its rewards, to freedom from exploitation and freedom of information. It is hardly surprising that working-class movements in many countries in the 19th and early 20th centuries found a memorable precedent, and some winning rhetoric, in the ancient story of how the concerted action of the Roman people wrung concessions from the hereditary patrician aristocracy and secured full political rights for the plebeians. Nor is it surprising that early trade unions could look to the plebeian walkouts as a model for a successful strike. But just how accurate is the story that the Romans told of this conflict, and what light does it shed on Rome's great leap forward? Here the pieces in the jigsaw puzzle become hard to fit together, but the outlines of a picture, and some probably crucial dates, do stand out. Many aspects of the story, as it has come down to us, must be wrong, heavily modernised by later writers, or, especially towards the beginning of the period of the conflict, still much more myth than history. Virginia is probably no less a fictional construct than Lucretia. There is an awkward mismatch between the surviving clauses of the 12 tables and the elaborate story of the Decemviri. Why, if the compilation came directly out of the clashes between patricians and plebeians, is there just one reference to that distinction in the marriage ban in the clauses preserved? Much of the argument, and even more of the rhetoric, of the early plebeian reformers is almost certainly an imaginative reconstruction by writers of the 1st century BCE, drawing on the sophisticated debates of their own day, rather than being a product of the world of the 12 tables. And it may well be better evidence for the popular political ideology of that later period than for the conflict of the orders. What is more, despite Roman certainty that the exclusion of plebeians from power in the state went back to the fall of the monarchy, there are hints that it developed only in the course of the 5th century BCE. The standard list of consuls, for example, however fictionalised it may be, includes in the early 5th century BCE plenty of recognisably plebeian names, including that of the first consul, Lucius Junius Brutus himself, which completely disappear in the second half of the century. That said, there is no doubt that long periods of the 5th and 4th centuries BCE were fractured by social and political struggles between a privileged, hereditary minority and the rest. More than half a millennium later, the formal distinction between patrician and plebeian families still survived as one of those fossils I discussed earlier, with a whiff of snobbery attached to it and not much more. It would be hard to explain why the distinction existed at all if the difference between the two groups had not once been a significant marker of political, social, and economic power. There are also strong reasons to think that the year 367 BCE was a major turning point, even if not in quite the way Roman historians imagined it. For them, this was the revolutionary moment when it was decided not only that the consulship should be open to plebeians, but that one of the two consuls must always be a plebeian. If so, the law was flouted as soon as it was made, as on several occasions in the following years, two patrician names are recorded as consuls. Livy noticed the problem and unconvincingly suggests that the plebeians were satisfied with getting the right to stand and not so bothered about being elected. Much more likely is that there was no obligatory plebeian consul, but that this was the year when the consulship as the major annual office of state was established on a permanent basis, presumably open to both patricians and plebeians. That would certainly fit with two other significant clues. First, even in the traditional Roman record, the entries for most of the years between the 420s and the 360s BCE name the mysterious colonels as the chief officials of the state. That changes once and for all in 367 BCE, when consuls become the norm for the rest of Roman history. Second, it may well be that the Senate was given its definitive form at this time. Roman writers tended to take it for granted that the origins of the Senate went back to Romulus as a council of old men, senes, and that by the 5th century BCE it was already a fully fledged institution operating much as it did in 63 BCE. One highly technical entry in an ancient Roman dictionary implies a very different version, suggesting that it was only around the middle of the 4th century BCE that the Senate was established as a permanent body with lifelong members, rather than just being an ad hoc group of friends and advisers to whatever officials were in charge, with no continuity from one year or even one day to the next. If this is correct, and of course not all arcane pieces of technical information necessarily are, then it backs up the idea that the Roman political system took its characteristic form in the mid-4th century BCE. Whatever the precursors, whatever elements such as assemblies or the census may long have been in place, Rome did not look distinctively Roman for more than a century after 509 BCE. That means that what we find outlined on Barbatus's tomb is not a traditional career of a traditional member of the Roman elite, though that is how he was later seen. Buried sometime in the early 3rd century BCE, Barbatus was in fact a representative of the relatively new republican order at home, and, as we shall now see, outside. The outside world, Veii and Rome. The expansion of Roman power through Italy was dramatic. It is easy to be dazzled or appalled by Rome's later overseas empire, which eventually amounted to more than 2 million square miles, while taking for granted the idea that Italy was Roman. But the transformation of the small town by the Tiber in 509 BCE into a polity of more than 5,000 square miles in the 290s BCE, with effective control over at least half the Italian peninsula and more to come, is almost as striking. How did that happen? And when? Rome's relations with the outside world were entirely unremarkable, so far as we can tell, until around 400 BCE. Its trading relations with the wider Mediterranean had been no more than typical for an Italian town. Its direct interactions were mainly local, above all with the Latin communities to the south, which shared a common language, a sense of common ancestry, and several common festivals and sacred sites with Rome. The most that can be said is that by the end of the 6th century BCE, the Romans probably had some kind of control over some of the other Latins. Both Cicero and the historian Polybius, a shrewd Greek observer of Rome, who features prominently in the next chapter, claim to have seen documents or treaties from that period, suggesting that Rome was then the leading player in this small, local Latin world. And as we have seen, the story of the 5th century BCE suggests more or less annual bouts of fighting, but on a limited scale in whatever grandiose terms it was later lauded. Quite simply, if there had been serious casualties every year for decades, the little town of Rome would not have survived. The moment of change came near the start of the 4th century BCE, with two events that play a leading and hugely mythologized role in all ancient accounts of Rome's expansion. The Romans' destruction of the nearby town of Veii under the heroic Camillus in 396 BCE and the destruction of Rome by Gauls in 390 BCE. What lay behind Rome's clash with Veii is completely unknown, but it was written up as if it were Italy's equivalent of the Trojan War, the 10-year siege that it took to capture the town equaling the 10-year siege of Troy, and the victorious Romans eventually popping up inside the city from a tunnel under the Temple of Juno as the equivalent of the Trojan horse. The reality of the conquest, which is probably too grand a term, must have been much more modest. This was not a clash of superpowers. Veii was a prosperous town, a little smaller than Rome, and just 10 miles away across the Tiber. Yet the consequences of Roman victory were significant. even if not in the way suggested by Roman writers, who emphasized the enslavement of the population, with all their goods and chattels taken as spoils, and the total destruction of the town. 350 years later, the poet Propertius conjured up a desolate picture of Veii in his day as the home of no more than sheep and a few idle shepherds. This is much more a moral lesson in the perils of defeat than an accurate description. Propertius may never have been to the place, for the archaeology of the site points to a very different truth. Although there may have been vicious looting, enslavement at the moment of Roman victory, and an influx of new settlers, most of the local sanctuaries remained in operation as they had been before. The town remained occupied, even if on a smaller scale, and such evidence as we have of the countryside farms points to continuity rather than rupture. The important change is of a different kind. Rome annexed Veii and its land, instantly increasing the size of Roman territory by about 60%. Soon after, four new geographical tribes of Roman citizens were created to include Veii, its indigenous inhabitants, as well as new settlers. There are hints of other important developments at roughly the same time, possibly connected. Livy claims that it was in the run-up to the siege of Veii that Roman soldiers were first paid from Roman taxes. Whether literally true or not, and whatever they were paid in, it was not yet coin, this may well be an indication of a move towards a more centralised organisation of Roman armies and the decline of private warfare. Defeat soon followed victory. The story went that in 390 BCE, a band of Gauls, possibly a tribe on the move looking for land, or more likely, a well-trained posse of mercenaries looking for work further south, routed a Roman army on the river Allia, not far from the city. The Romans apparently did little more than run away, and the Gauls marched on to take Rome. One apocryphal tale describes how a virtuous plebeian, the aptly named Marcus Caedicius, disaster-teller, heard the voice of some unknown god warning him that the Gauls were approaching. But his report was ignored because of his lowly status. It turned out to be a lesson for the patricians. Learned the hard way that the gods communicated with plebeians too. Roman storytelling gave extravagant coverage to the capture of the city, with various acts of heroism mitigating the widespread destruction. Another poor man gave proof of plebeian piety when he threw his wife and children out of his cart and gave a lift to the Vestal Virgins, who were evacuating their sacred emblems and talismans to safety in the nearby town of Caere. Many elderly aristocrats decided simply to face the inevitable and sat patiently at home, waiting for the Gauls, who for a moment mistook the old men for statues before massacring them. Meanwhile, Camillus, briefly in exile for the alleged embezzlement of spoils, returned just in time to stop the Romans from paying a large ransom to the Gauls, to dissuade his compatriots from simply abandoning the city and moving to Veii, and to take charge of refounding the city. Or that, at least, is one version. A less honourable telling of the story has the Gauls triumphantly carrying off the ransom. This is another case of Roman exaggeration. The various stories which became commonplaces of Roman cultural memory offered important patriotic lessons. In placing the claims of country above family, in bravery in the face of certain defeat, and in the dangers of measuring the worth of the city in terms of gold. The catastrophe became so much a part of the Roman popular imagination that some diehards were using it in 48 CE as an argument, or a desperate gambit, against the Emperor Claudius's proposal to admit Gauls into the Senate. There is, however, no archaeological evidence for the kind of massive destruction that later Romans imagined, unless those traces of burning now dated to around 500 BCE are, in fact, as archaeologists once thought, the remains of a Gallic rampage 100 years later. The one clear surviving mark of the sack on the Roman landscape is the vast defensive city wall, of which some impressive sections are still visible, constructed after the departure of the Gauls and built with some particularly durable stone that was one of the products of Rome's new territory around Veii. But there were powerful reasons why this defeat was a useful episode for Roman historians to stress. It set the scene for Roman anxieties about invaders from over the Alps, of whom Hannibal was the most dangerous, but not the only one. It helped to explain why so little hard information survived for early Rome. It had gone up in flames, and so it marked the start, in ancient terms, of modern history. It answered the question of why, in the later Republic, the city of Rome, despite its world renown, was such an ill-planned rabbit warren. The Romans had had to rebuild hurriedly when the Gauls left, and it opened a new chapter in Rome's relations with the outside world. The Romans versus Alexander the Great. What followed was a revolution in the size, scale, location, and consequence of Roman conflict. True, the basic pattern of more or less annual warfare continued. Ancient writers thrilled to a long list of Roman battles fought in the 4th century BCE, celebrating and no doubt exaggerating heroic victories while lamenting a handful of shameful defeats and humiliating walkovers. The Battle of the Caudine Forks in 321 BCE, at which the South Italian Samnites trounced the Romans, became almost as resonant as the Battle of the Allia or the sack of Rome 70 years earlier, even though it was not really a battle at all. The Romans were trapped in a narrow mountain gully, the Forks, with no water, and they simply surrendered. Yet between the sack of Rome in 390 BCE and the Battle of Sentinum in 295 BCE, the manpower involved in these conflicts increased dramatically. Campaigns were fought further and further from Rome. Whereas Veii was 10 miles up the road, Sentinum was some 200 miles away across the Apennines, and the arrangements made between Rome and the defeated had far-reaching consequences for the future. The military impact of Rome by the end of the 4th century BCE was so great that Livy felt it worthwhile to compare Roman prowess with that of the world-conquering Alexander the Great, who between 334 and 323 BCE had led his Macedonian army on a spree of conquest from Greece to India. Livy wondered who would have won, the Romans or the Macedonians, if they had come head to head. A military conundrum that armchair generals still ponder. There were two particularly significant conflicts in Italy in this period. First was the so-called Latin War, fought against Rome's Latin neighbours between 341 and 338 BCE. Shortly after followed the Samnite Wars, the occasion of Barbatus's victories. They were fought in phases between 343 and 290 BCE against a group of communities based in the mountainous parts of southern Italy, Samnites, who were much less rough and primitive than it suited the Romans to portray them, but less urbanized than those in many other parts of the peninsula. Both of these wars are rather artificial constructions, isolating two enemies and giving their names to the much more widespread endemic fighting of the period, from a decidedly Romano-centric point of view. No Samnite ever fought a Samnite war. That said, they do spotlight some important changes. According to the usual story, the first was prompted by a revolt of the Latins against the dominant position of the Romans in the region. It remained a local conflict, but it was notable, even revolutionary, for the arrangements made afterwards between the Romans and the various Latin communities. For these gave Roman citizenship to vast numbers of the defeated in numerous towns throughout central Italy, on a scale that went far beyond the precedent set at Veii. Whether this was a gesture of generosity, as many Roman writers interpreted it, or a mechanism of oppression, as it may well have seemed to those who found Roman citizenship imposed upon them, it was a crucial stage in the changing definition of what it meant to be Roman, and it brought, as we shall see, enormous changes to the structure of Roman power. Almost 50 years later, the decades of Samnite Wars ended, with more than half the peninsula under Rome's thumb in various ways, from treaties of friendship to direct control. Roman writers presented these wars as if they were a struggle between two states for Italian supremacy. They were certainly not that, but the scale of the conflict was something new and set the stage for the future. At the Battle of Sentinum, the Romans faced a large group of enemies. Alliance may be too formal a word for it. The Samnites themselves, as well as Etruscans and Gauls from the far north of the peninsula. The sheer number of combatants seemed to have attracted the attention of Duris of Samos, who recorded a vast but implausible total of 100,000 Samnite and allied casualties. Roman writers saw this as a particularly heroic victory. It even became the theme of a jingoistic Roman tragedy 200 years later, complete with a tragic chorus of Roman soldiers and featuring one of the Roman commanders who gave up his life to ensure his army's success. But they too debated, as modern scholars have continued to do, just how big this biggest of all battles was. Livy had no patience with the estimates on the scale of Duris, or with even more inflated figures he came across in his researches. Whether his estimate of Roman forces at around 16,000 men, plus as many allies, is correct, it is impossible to know. One thing is certain, however. This was a different military world from the low-level skirmishes of the 5th century BCE. It is a world we can still glimpse in an extraordinary discovery made in the 1870s in excavations at what would have been the edge of the ancient city of Rome, a tantalizingly small fragment of painting from a tomb probably dating to the early 3rd century BCE. Originally much more extensive, covering a whole wall, it is arranged in a series of registers, one above the other, which are thought to feature scenes from these conflicts between Rome and the Samnites. If so, this is the first surviving painting in the West to show an identifiable real-life military campaign, unless a rather generic scene of combat painted on a tomb in South Italy is actually, as some archaeologists have optimistically imagined, a proud depiction of the Samnite victory at the Caudine Forks. The interpretation of the painting has been hugely controversial, and it is now sadly eroded, but the main outline is clear enough. The lowest register depicts hand-to-hand fighting, dominated by a man whose elaborate helmet extends into the scene above. Higher up, some imposing battlements still stand out. Each of the two best-preserved scenes shows a man in a short toga holding a spear. One of these, and possibly both, is named Q. Fabius, plausibly the Quintus Fabius Maximus Rullianus, who was commanding officer at Sentinum and who gave Barbatus his only known cameo role in the battle, instructing him to bring up the reserves from the rear. Here he is shown, with a retinue of hangers-on behind him on a distinctly smaller scale, apparently in negotiation with Fannius, a warrior with no weapons, dressed in military kit, including heavy leg guards, and in one case a plumed helmet, who is extending his bare right hand. Is Fannius a Samnite, surrendering to a representative of the race that wears the toga? Here, already in the 3rd century BCE, depicted as exactly that. Seen in these simple, stylized images, the Romans may not look much of a match for Alexander the Great, but whether or not they would have been is precisely the issue Livy raises in the long digression in his history, just after the description of the impressive Roman recovery from the humiliation at the Caudine Forks. It did not escape his notice that the Samnite Wars were taking place in Italy at the end of the 4th century BCE, which was more or less when the Macedonian king was on his devastating campaigns in the east. By Livy's day, Roman generals had long been keen to emulate Alexander. They had imitated his distinctive hairstyle. They had called themselves the Great, and both Julius Caesar and the first emperor Augustus had made a pilgrimage to Alexander's tomb in Egypt. Augustus, so it was said, accidentally breaking off the corpse's nose as he paid homage. So it is perhaps not surprising that Livy pondered a classic counterfactual question. Who would have won if Alexander had turned his army westward and faced the Romans instead of the Persians? Alexander, he concedes, was a great general, though not without his faults, drunkenness among others. But the Romans had the advantage of not depending on a single charismatic leader. They had depth in their command, supported by extraordinary military discipline. They also, he insisted, could call on far greater numbers of well-trained troops and, thanks to Roman alliances throughout Italy, summon reinforcements more or less at will. His answer, in short, was that, if given the chance, the Romans would have beaten Alexander. Expansion, soldiers and citizens. In his roundabout way, Livy, who sometimes seems rather plodding in his analysis, offers a perceptive answer to the questions of what made the Roman armies at this period so good at winning, and how it came about that Rome extended control so rapidly over so much of Italy. This is one of the few cases in which he looks beneath the surface of the narrative to underlying social and structural factors. From the organisation of Roman command to Rome's resources of manpower. It is worth pushing Livy's point a little further, to think harder about what was, in retrospect, the beginning of the Roman Empire. Two things are clear and undermine a couple of misleading modern myths about Roman power and character. First, the Romans were not by nature more belligerent than their neighbours and contemporaries, any more than they were naturally better at building roads and bridges. It is true that Roman culture placed an extraordinary, for us uncomfortably, high value on success in fighting. Prowess, bravery and deadly violence in battle were repeatedly celebrated, from the successful general parading through the streets and the cheering crowds in his triumphal procession, to the rank-and-file soldiers showing off their battle scars in the middle of political debates, in the hope of adding weight to their arguments. In the middle of the 4th century BCE, the base of the main platform for speakers in the forum was decorated with the bronze rams of enemy warships captured from the city of Antium during the Latin War, as if to symbolise the military foundation of Roman political power. The Latin word for rams, rostra, became the name of the platform and gave modern English its word rostrum. Yet it would be naive to imagine that the other peoples in Italy were different. These were very disparate groups, much more varied in language, culture and political organisation than the shorthand Italians implies. But to judge from the comparatively little we know about most of them, from the military equipment found in their graves, or the occasional passing references in literature to their spoils, warfare and atrocities, they were just as committed to militarism as the Romans, and probably just as greedy for profit. This was a world where violence was endemic. Skirmishes with neighbours were annual events, plunder was a significant revenue stream for everyone, and most disputes were resolved by force. The ambivalence of the Latin word hostis nicely captures the blurring of the boundary between the outsider and the enemy. So too does the standard Latin phrase for at home and abroad. Domi militarque, in which abroad, militiae, is indistinguishable from on military campaign. Most of the peoples in the peninsula no doubt shared that blurring. To be off one's home turf was always, potentially, to be at war. Second, the Romans did not plan to conquer and control Italy. No Roman cabal in the 4th century BCE sat down with a map, plotting a land grab in the territorial way that we associate with imperialist nation-states in the 19th and 20th centuries. For a start, simple as it sounds, they had no maps. What this implies for how they, or any other pre-cartographic people, conceived the world around them or just over their horizons, is one of history's great mysteries. I have tended to write of the spread of Roman power through the peninsula of Italy, but no one knows how many, or realistically, how few, Romans at this date thought of their homeland as part of a peninsula in the way we picture it. A rudimentary version of the idea is perhaps implied by references in literature of the 2nd century BCE to the Adriatic as the Upper Sea and the Tyrrhenian as the Lower Sea. But notably, this is on a different orientation from ours, east-west rather than north-south. These Romans saw their expansion more in terms of changing relationships with other peoples than in terms of control of territory. Of course, Rome's growing power did dramatically transform the landscape of Italy. There was little that was more obviously transformative than a brand new Roman road, striking out across empty fields or land being annexed and divided up among new settlers. It continues to be convenient to measure Roman power in Italy in terms of geographical area. Yet Roman dominion was primarily over people, not places. As Livy saw, the relations that the Romans formed with those people were the key to the dynamics of early Roman expansion. There was one obligation that the Romans imposed on all those who came under their control, namely, to provide troops for the Roman armies. In fact, for most of those who were defeated by Rome and forced or welcomed into some form of alliance, the only long-term obligation seems to have been the provision and upkeep of soldiers. These peoples were not taken over by Rome in any other way. They had no Roman occupying force or Roman-imposed government. Why this form of control was chosen is impossible to know, but it is unlikely that any particularly sophisticated strategic calculation was involved. It was an imposition that conveniently demonstrated Roman dominance, while requiring few Roman administrative structures or spare manpower to manage. The troops that the Allies contributed were raised, equipped, and in part commanded by the locals. Taxation in any other form would have been much more labour-intensive for the Romans. Direct control of those they had defeated would have been even more so. The results may well have been unintended, but they were groundbreaking. For this system of alliances became an effective mechanism for converting Rome's defeated enemies into part of its growing military machine, and at the same time it gave those allies a stake in the Roman enterprise, thanks to the booty and glory that were shared in the event of victory. Once the Romans' military success started, they managed to make it self-sustaining, in a way that no other ancient city had ever systematically done. For the single most significant factor behind the victory at this period was not tactics, equipment, skill, or motivation. It was how many men you could deploy. By the end of the 4th century BCE, the Romans had probably not far short of 500,000 troops available. Compare the 50,000 or so soldiers under Alexander in his eastern campaigns, or perhaps 100,000 when the Persians invaded Greece in 481 BCE. This made them close to invincible in Italy. They might lose a battle, but not a war. Or, as one Roman poet put it in the 130s BCE, the Roman people has often been defeated by force and overcome in many battles, but never in an actual war on which everything depends. There were, however, other far-reaching implications of the way the Romans defined their relations with other peoples in Italy. The Allies, who were committed to no more than supplying manpower, were the most numerous, but they were only one of the categories concerned. To some communities over wide areas in central Italy, the Romans extended Roman citizenship. Sometimes this involved full citizen rights and privileges, including the right to vote or stand in Roman elections, while also continuing to be a citizen of a local town. In other cases, they offered a more limited form of rights that came to be known, self-explanatorily, as citizenship without the vote, or civitas sine suffragio. There were also people who lived on conquered territories in settlements known as colonies, coloniae. These had nothing to do with colonies in the modern sense of the word, but were new or expanded towns, usually made up of a mixture of locals and settlers from Rome. A few had full Roman citizenship status. Most had what was known as Latin rights. That was not citizenship as such, but a package of rights believed to have been shared since time immemorial by the Latin towns, later formally defined as intermarriage with Romans, mutual rights to make contracts, free movement, and so on. It was a halfway house between having full citizenship and being a foreigner or hostis. How this complicated mosaic of statuses had originated is again hard to know. Roman writers of the 1st century BCE, followed by modern legal scholars, tended to treat them as part of a highly technical, carefully calibrated system of civic rights and responsibilities. But that is almost certainly the product of later legal rationalisation. It is inconceivable that the men of the 4th century BCE sat down to debate the precise implications of civitas sine suffragio, or the exact privileges that went with belonging to a Latin colony. Much more likely, they were improvising their new relationships with different peoples in the outside world by using and adjusting their existing rudimentary categories of citizenship and ethnicity. The implications, however, were again revolutionary in extending citizenship to people who had no direct territorial connections with the city of Rome. They broke the link, which most people in the classical world took for granted, between citizenship and a single city. In a systematic way that was then unparalleled, they made it possible not just to become Roman, but also to be a citizen of two places at once: one's hometown and Rome. And in creating new Latin colonies all over Italy, they redefined the word Latin so that it was no longer an ethnic identity, but a political status unrelated to race or geography. This set the stage for a model of citizenship and belonging that had enormous significance for Roman ideas of government, political rights, ethnicity, and nationhood. This model was shortly extended overseas and eventually underpinned the Roman Empire. Causes and explanations. There is no more vivid symbol of Rome's changed relationship to the outside world in the early 4th century BCE than the vast wall erected around the city in the years after the Gauls left, with a perimeter of 7 miles and in places as much as 4 metres thick. It was simultaneously a mammoth building project, more than 5 million man-hours of labour in the construction, according to one estimate, and a boastful symbol of Rome's prominence and place in the world. There is no doubt, as both ancient and modern historians agree, that it was around this time that Rome's military expansion outside its immediate neighbourhood began. Nor is there any doubt that the expansion once started was sustained more than anything by the resources of manpower that came with the alliances that followed its victories. But what caused the change in the first place is a tricky question. What happened in the early 4th century BCE to start this new phase of Roman military activity? No ancient writer hazards an answer, beyond the implausible idea that the seed of world domination had somehow been planted. Maybe the invasion of the Gauls produced in the Romans a determination not to be caught out like that again, to take the offensive rather than being forced onto the defensive. Maybe it took only a couple of lucky victories in the endemic fighting of the region, followed by a couple of alliances and the extra manpower they brought, to ignite the process of expansion. Whatever the case, it seems likely that the dramatic changes in domestic politics had some part to play. So far, in exploring this period, I have largely kept the internal history of Rome separate from the story of its expansion. It makes for a clearer story, but it tends to obscure the impact of politics at home on relations further afield, and vice versa. By 367 BCE, the conflict of the orders had done something far more significant and wide-ranging than simply end political discrimination against the plebeians. It had effectively replaced a governing class defined by birth with one defined by wealth and achievement. That is partly the point of Barbatus's epitaph. Patrician though the Scipio family was, what counts here are the offices he held, the personal qualities he displayed, and the battles he won. No achievement was more demonstrable or more celebrated than victory in battle, and the desire for victory among the new elite was almost certainly an important factor in intensifying military activity and encouraging warfare. Equally, it was power over increasingly far-flung peoples and the demands of a conquering army that drove many of the innovations that revolutionized life in Rome itself. One important example of this is coinage. From early in its history, the city had a standard system of determining monetary value by weight of metal. This is evident in the 12 tables, which assesses penalties in units of bronze. But there was no coinage as such until the end of the 4th century BCE, when Roman coins were first minted in South Italy, probably to pay for warfare or road building there. More generally, if we were to ask what transformed the relatively simple world of the 12 tables into the relatively complex world of the year 300 BCE, the most influential factor would surely be the sheer size of Rome's dominion and the organizational demands of fighting on a large scale. Simply the logistics of transport, supply, and equipment entailed in mounting a campaign of 16,000 Romans, to use Livy's estimate, plus allies, would have demanded an infrastructure unthinkable in the mid-5th century BCE. Although I have tried to avoid such modernizing terms as alliance and treaty when referring to Roman activity in the 5th century BCE, the network of Roman connections throughout the peninsula and the different definitions of Rome's relations with different communities by the end of the following century make those terms much less inappropriate. Roman military expansion drove Roman sophistication. The family tomb of Scipio Barbatus now looks grandly archaic, and, with its coarse local stone, rather crudely carved decoration and slightly antiquated spelling, consul instead of consul, for example. It might well have seemed quaintly old-fashioned to any Roman who entered it in the 1st century BCE. But in his day, Barbatus was part of a new generation who defined a new way of being Roman and a new place for Rome in the world. His descendants took that even further, and it is to them we now turn. Chapter 5. A Wider World. The Descendants of Barbatus. Scipio Barbatus built his tomb on a grand scale, and over the next 150 years, around 30 of his descendants joined him there. The Scipio family included some of the most famous names of Roman history, as well as its fair share of also-rans and ne'er-do-wells. 8 of their epitaphs survive more or less complete, and several of those commemorate the kind of Romans usually hidden from history, the ones who did not quite make the grade, or who died young, and the women. He who has been buried here was never surpassed in virtus. Just 20 years of age, he was entrusted to the tomb, in case you ask why no political office was entrusted to him. The text on one sarcophagus of the middle of the 2nd century BCE explains slightly defensively. Another has to fall back on the achievements of the young man's father. His father crushed King Antiochus, but others had more to boast of. The epitaph of Barbatus's son proclaims, "He captured Corsica and the city of Illyria, and in gratitude dedicated a temple to the gods of storms." A storm had nearly wrecked his fleet, and this was his thank offering to the appropriate gods for the happy outcome. Other members of the family would have had even greater boasts. Publius Cornelius Scipio Africanus, a great-grandson of Barbatus, was the man who, in 202 BCE, secured the final defeat of Hannibal. He invaded the Carthaginians' home territory in North Africa, and at the Battle of Zama, near Carthage, routed his army with some help from Hannibal's elephants, who ran amok and trampled over their own side. Africanus's grave lay on his estate in South Italy and became something of a pilgrimage site for later Romans. But it is almost certain that among the memorials in the family tomb were once those of his brother, Lucius Cornelius Scipio Asiaticus, the man who crushed King Antiochus of Syria in 190 BCE, his cousin Gnaeus Cornelius Scipio Hispalus, a consul in 176 BCE, and his grandson, Publius Cornelius Scipio Aemilianus. An adopted member of the family, Aemilianus invaded North Africa and finished Africanus's work. In 146 BCE, he reduced the ancient city of Carthage to rubble and sold most of its surviving inhabitants into slavery. The careers of these men point to a new world of Roman politics and expansion over the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE. These are some of the key players, famous or infamous, in the series of military campaigns that gave the Roman Republic control over the whole Mediterranean and beyond. Their rather cumbersome names nicely sum up that new world. Barbatus presumably points to the bearer's appearance, and Aemilianus is a reference to the man's natural father, Lucius Aemilius Paulus, but Africanus, Asiaticus, and Hispalus, from his father's service in Spain, Hispania, reflect the new horizons of Roman power. One reasonable way of translating Scipio Africanus would be Scipio Hammer of Africa. These were military men, but there was more to the Scipios than that, and anyone would have realized who spotted the statue of the Roman poet Quintus Ennius proudly displayed alongside those of Africanus and Asiaticus on the elegant facade of the family tomb. They were also in the thick of the Roman literary revolution, sponsors and patrons of the first generation of Roman literature. This was no coincidence, for the origin of literature at Rome was closely associated with Roman overseas expansion. The muse imposed herself in warlike fashion on the fierce inhabitants of Rome, as one 2nd century BCE author described it. The beginnings of empire and the beginnings of literature were two sides of the same coin. For centuries, Romans had used writing for various purposes: public notices, rules and regulations, claims of ownership scrawled on a pot. But it was increasing contact with the traditions of the Greek world from the mid-3rd century BCE that was the catalyst to the production and preservation of literature as such. It was born in imitation of Greek predecessors and in dialogue, competition and rivalry at a moment that speaks for itself. In 241 BCE, just as Roman soldiers and sailors were finally winning Rome's first overseas war in the predominantly Greek island of Sicily, somewhere back home, a man called Livius Andronicus was busy adapting into Latin, from a Greek original, the first tragedy to be shown in Rome, which was staged the very next year, in 240 BCE. The background and output of Livius Andronicus are typical of the cultural mix of this early writing and of its writers. He produced Latin versions not only of Greek tragedies, but also of Homer's Odyssey. He had been enslaved as a prisoner of war, probably from the Greek city of Tarentum in South Italy, and later freed. A different mixture is seen in Fabius Pictor, the Roman senator who wrote the first history of Rome. Roman born and bred, he nevertheless composed his work in Greek, only later translated into Latin. The earliest literature actually to survive in any bulk, written around the turn of the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE, the 26 comedies of Titus Macius Plautius and Publius Terentius Afer, Plautus and Terence from now on, are carefully Romanized versions of Greek predecessors, featuring hapless love stories and farcical tales of mistaken identity, often set in Athens, but also sprinkled with gags about togas, public baths, and triumphal parades. Terence, who lived in the early 2nd century BCE, was reputed to be another ex-slave, originally from Carthage. As the statue on the outside of the tomb suggests, Scipio Africanus was one of the sponsors of Ennius, most famous for his multi-volume Latin epic poem on the history of Rome from the Trojan War until his own day, at the beginning of the 2nd century BCE, and another South Italian, fluent in Latin, Greek, and his native Oscan, a reminder of the linguistic variety of the peninsula. Aemilianus flaunted even stronger literary interests in both Latin and Greek. He had such close connections with Terence that inventive Roman gossips wondered whether he had ghost-written some of the plays. Wasn't the Latin just too elegant for someone of Terence's background? And Aemilianus was known to have the Greek literary classics on the tip of his tongue. As Carthage went up in flames in 146 BCE, one eyewitness spotted him shedding a tear and heard him quoting from memory an apposite line on the fall of Troy from Homer's Iliad. He was reflecting that one day the same fate might afflict Rome. Crocodile tears or not, they made their point. That eyewitness was the closest of Aemilianus's literary friends and connections, a Greek historian resident in Rome by the name of Polybius. A shrewd observer of Roman politics at home and abroad, with a unique perspective on Rome from the inside and the outside, he hovers over much of the rest of this chapter. As the first writer to pose some of the big questions that we shall try to answer. Why and how did the Romans come to dominate so much of the Mediterranean in such a short time? What was distinctive about the Roman political system? Or, as Polybius sternly put it, who could be so indifferent or so idle that they did not want to find out how and under what kind of political organization almost the whole of the inhabited world was conquered and fell under the sole power of the Romans in less than 53 years, something previously unparalleled. Who indeed? Conquest and consequences. Polybius's 53 years covered the end of the 3rd and the beginning of the 2nd century BCE, but it was some 60 years earlier that the Romans first encountered an enemy from overseas. That was Pyrrhus, the ruler of a kingdom in northern Greece, who, in 280 BCE, sailed to Italy to support the town of Tarentum against the Romans. His self-deprecating joke that his victories against Rome cost him so many men that he could not afford another lies behind the modern phrase Pyrrhic victory, meaning one that takes such a heavy toll that it is tantamount to defeat. The phrase is rather kind to the Roman side of the story, for Pyrrhus was a serious match for them. Hannibal is supposed to have rated him the greatest military leader after Alexander the Great, and, according to a number of affectionate anecdotes, he was something of an engaging showman. He was the first to pull off the stunt of bringing elephants to Italy, and on one occasion is supposed to have tried, unsuccessfully, to disconcert a visiting Roman by revealing one of his beasts from behind a curtain. He is also the first character in the history of Rome to whom we can plausibly put a face. From the invasion of Pyrrhus to 146 BCE, when Roman armies destroyed both Carthage at the end of what was called the Third Punic War, from the Latin Punicus, or Carthaginian, and, almost simultaneously, the wealthy Greek city of Corinth, there was more or less continuous warfare involving Rome and its enemies in the Italian peninsula and overseas. One ancient scholar isolated the year when Gaius Atilius and Titus Manius were consuls, 235 BCE, as the only point in this period when hostilities were not taking place. The most celebrated and devastating conflicts were the first two Punic Wars against Carthage. The earlier lasted for more than 20 years, from 264 to 241 BCE, largely fought in Sicily and on the seas round about, except for one disastrous Roman excursion to the Carthaginian homeland in North Africa. It ended with Sicily under Roman control, and after a few years Sardinia and Corsica too, though the epitaph of Barbatus's son rather exaggerates his achievements in capturing the island. In one extraordinary recent find, some of the detritus of the final naval battle between Romans and Carthaginians has been dragged up from the bottom of the Mediterranean. Just off the Sicilian coast, close to where the two fleets are supposed to have met, underwater archaeologists exploring the area since 2004 have recovered several bronze rams from sunken warships, mostly Roman, but including one Carthaginian vessel, together with at least 8 bronze helmets, one carrying a trace of some Punic graffiti, probably scratched by its drowned owner, and pottery amphorae that must have been carrying the ship's supplies. On a very different geographical scale was the Second Punic War, which was fought between 218 and 201 BCE. It is now best remembered for the heroic failure of Hannibal, who crossed the Alps with his elephants, more of a propaganda coup than a practical military asset, and inflicted vast casualties on the Romans in Italy, most notoriously in 216 BCE at the Battle of Cannae in the south. Only after more than a decade of inconclusive warfare did Hannibal's home government, increasingly uneasy about the whole escapade, and now with the invading army of Africanus to face, recall him to Carthage. But it was not merely an Italian and North African war. It had started with a clash between Romans and Carthaginians in Spain, hence the Roman fighting there through most of the 2nd century BCE. And the possibility of support for Hannibal from Macedon pushed the Romans into a series of wars in northern Greece that ended with the defeat of the Macedonian king, Perseus, in 168 BCE by Aemilius Paulus, Scipio Aemilianus's natural father, and soon after with Roman control over the whole of what we call mainland Greece. What is more, the Romans were also engaged in major conflicts with the Gauls in the far north of Italy in the 220s BCE. They made periodic interventions across the Adriatic too, partly to deal with so-called pirates, a catch-all term for enemies in ships, who were supported by the tribes and kingdoms on the opposite coast, or so it was said. And in 190 BCE, under the command of Scipio Asiaticus, they decisively defeated Antiochus the Great of Syria. Not only was he busy modelling himself on Alexander the Great and extending his power base accordingly, but he had also given a home to Hannibal, now in exile from Carthage, who was reputed to be offering the king masterclasses in how to confront the Romans. Military campaigning was a defining feature of Roman life, and Roman writers organised the history of this period, as I have just done, around its succession of wars, giving them the shorthand titles that have often stuck till the present day. When Sallust called his essay on Catiline's plot, The War Against Catiline, or Bellum Catilinae, He was reflecting, and maybe slightly parodying, the Roman tradition of seeing war as the structuring principle of history. It was a